Hare Krishna. So it's such a pleasure to be back here at ISKCON Silicon Valley. This is, of all my various invitations, this is definitely one that I don't like to miss because I think I mentioned last time as well that this is definitely the best listening audience in the United States. A group of serious and steady and learned and inquisitive listeners here, that it's really a pleasure, it's a treat for any speaker, I think. So I always get more than I can give, I think, in ISKCON Silicon Valley, and I want to thank His Grace Vaisheshika Prabhu specifically for extending the invitation and for facilitating and nurturing this community of listeners. It's really a rare thing, actually, in the world to have a community of sincere listeners. It's a difficult skill to have, and it's a very great asset for a person to have. And people think of it as the easiest thing in the world. You just have to sit there, right? There's nothing much you got to do when you listen. But in fact, it's one of the most difficult skills to cultivate. It really is. It's at least as difficult as the other services that we do, even though they sometimes look more complicated. But listening is actually a very challenging skill. I know this from my experience because I teach university students, and it's very often that we have to do a whole song and dance in order to get them to listen, and even then sometimes it doesn't work. It's again a great privilege to have a community of good listeners. So we can begin with the Mangalacharana prayers. Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamahyam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhanvitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dinabandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Vyayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishthaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamin Niti Namine Namaste Sarasvate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabho Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So as Vaisheshika Prabhu has already mentioned, this is a seminar called Sanskrit for Scriptural Study. And the purpose of this seminar is not to teach us Sanskrit per se, because it would be completely impossible unless we were totally from another world to learn Sanskrit in the matter of a weekend. That's not the purpose, and I think for most of us it's that would not be even useful. But the goal of this seminar is slightly different, which is to give us the resources to do better something that we all do or should be doing, which is the regular study of Srila Prabhupada's books. And these books have significant amounts of Sanskrit in them, and Srila Prabhupada put that Sanskrit in his books very purposefully, very consciously, because not all editions of Bhagavad Gita, for example, or the Upanishads include the Sanskrit within them. But Srila Prabhupada was particular about that, and he included it in his books. And even for the study of just the translations or the purports, even if we're not interested in the actual verses themselves, even then, a knowledge of certain aspects of the language make it easier and to study those books and more effective in our study. We as devotees have an intuitive sense after many years of study of Prabhupada's books about a lot of the things that we'll speak about today and tomorrow. But it's nice to formalize that sense so that we know what it is that we're reading and and how it's coming forward. Actually, I did get a glass, but I left it there. It's just right here. Thank you. So that's the idea, and we're going to cover several things, and in a depth that's appropriate to the time we have. We're going to talk, actually, most importantly, about pronunciation, because there's one thing in terms of the study of Sanskrit that Prabhupada actually gave many instructions repeatedly to his disciples at various points to be able to read and recite the verses, to pronounce them well as an aid to our study and our aid to our outreach and preaching work. So that's going to be a major focus, is reciting different verses, how to recognize what metrical pattern those verses are in so that we can find a melody that's suitable. I think we've all been in a situation where we try our best to read a particular verse, maybe while giving class or trying to recite the verse in our own home, and struggling to make it fit into the proper melody and the proper recitation. So that's going to be a major focus. Perhaps if we have time, we will also look at the idea of samasas or compound words, because we encounter them a lot and they affect the meaning of what we're doing. We'll also talk a little bit about the structure of the language as well as the combination of different words together called sandhi. Now, how many people here have had some exposure to Sanskrit learning, maybe as children or as adults and at some point? Okay, so this is what I thought, is that generally if you're speaking to an audience of Indian background, then there's some exposure to the Sanskrit language. Some of the more kind of elementary aspects of the pronunciation we can leave behind or go over just very quickly for the sake of completeness, and then focus on things that are of greater use and interest to you. At the same time, this is kind of a vast area of knowledge, as you can imagine. And so if there are specific areas that you have questions about or you find challenging in your own study, then please don't hesitate to ask at the appropriate time during the seminar, because I'm happy to go into it in further detail. Of course, if it's a very minute grammatical question as a result of, because you're yourself studying Sanskrit systematically over several years, then we can take that individually rather than in the class. But if it's something that would be of benefit to the devotees and has to do with applying the Sanskrit knowledge and study, then we should we can take that and move in that direction, because I'm happy to adjust the contents of the seminar according to the needs of the audience. So that's the basic overview. But before we actually get into the specific language itself, I want to speak in this first session about some of the ethos of learning Sanskrit and the background of the Sanskritic culture that is found in our books and in our Vaishnav heritage. To start off with, we, on a regular basis, we hear statements like this, right? We say, for example, that one line, Prabhupada said himself, that one line of his books can change a person's life, right? And we repeat this very often. Or we say that these books are a transcendental sound vibration, even though they're written, so technically they're not sound and they're not vibrating. So yet we say it's a sound vibration, right? We also say that the process begins through hearing about Krishna, and Krishna is seen through the ears, right? This is found in Srimad Bhagavatam as well. We also say that chanting of Hare Krishna creates peace and prosperity in the world. And finally, we talk often about Vedic culture and about the Vedas and Vedic literature in general, to refer to the entire body of books and literature that we have. So all of these statements that we hear regularly are grounded, actually, they're attributable to the Vedas and to the four original Vedas and the ancient Vedic culture that is really no longer practiced and can no longer be practiced very well in this Kali Yuga. So the first thing I wanted to do today is actually talk to you a little bit about the Vedas. These four books, and specifically, I mean Vedas a little narrowly here, these four books, Rig, Yajur, Sama, and Atharva Vedas, the four Samhitas, and help us to understand. These are essentially the origin of the Sanskrit language, the first recorded use of Sanskrit in history, in time, is in these four books of the Vedas, right? These are ancient works, and both scholars and devotees agree that they are the oldest written records of the Sanskrit language. So any study of Sanskrit should begin with an appreciation for the Vedas. But this is especially useful because we speak a lot about the Vedas and Vedic culture and the glories of Vedic culture, and yet we have, not often a full understanding of what makes that Vedic culture so great as a culture of learning, right, as a culture of knowledge. Furthermore, we also often criticize the Vedas as well. In fact, not just us, but Krishna also criticizes the Vedas, right? He says, Traigunyo Vishaya Veda, Nistraigunyo Bhavarjuna. He says, these Vedas deal with the three gunas, the three modes of material nature in the material world. O Arjun, become transcendental to the three modes. He says, men whose knowledge is confused by the flowery language of the Vedas, they cannot focus on spiritual life very well. So, on the one hand, we're always praising the Vedas and aligning ourselves, pledging allegiance to the Vedic culture. And on the other hand, we're sometimes criticizing the Vedas in the line of Krishna and criticizing them as karmakanda, etc. So, the question I want to address is, what are these Vedas and what makes them great and what makes them wonderful and what makes them not all that great and a little less than wonderful, okay? Let's talk a little bit about the Vedas, okay? And again, specifically speaking, the oldest layer, Rig, Yajur, Sama, and Atharva. These are apaurusheya. That means they are agreed upon by all members of the orthodox Vedic traditions that they are eternal. They are not created by any human being. They are revealed over time as and when is useful and appropriate for us, okay? These four Vedas consists of different mantras, many thousands of different mantras that are used in sacrifice and yajna. Most of us, I think, we know this. These mantras were passed down over time for thousands of years orally through spoken hearing memorization. Okay, so one person speaks, the other person hears and memorizes by repeated practice, and then passes it down to the next student. And so this chain of parampara is an oral chain of knowledge, only getting written down relatively recently, in the past couple thousand years or so, if not later. Before that, it was basically considered to be sacrilegious to actually write down the Vedas, something not very good to do. The reason for that is because the Vedas were passed down in a way that was so precise. You see, normally when we think of oral transmission, then we think of stories and rumors that are orally transmitted. Just like if I tell you, you know this game of Chinese whispers, sometimes they call it, if I tell you some story or idea, and I say, please pass it exactly to the next person next to you, and you try to pass it exactly to the next person, and in this way you pass it on all the way back, and it finally gets to Vaisheshika Prabhu, then what I told her and what he hears in the end is going to be very different, right? You can try this sometime, and it's true. There's significant changes that take place. It'll be more or less the same story. You know, if I tell you the Ramayana, he'll still hear some version of the Ramayana, and it'll be recognizable as the Ramayana. Ram will still be there, and Ravana will be still there, and Sita will be there, and Hanuman will be there, right? But the details will get lost, will get confused. That's assuming that everyone in that chain is sincere and is trying to do their best to transmit it accurately. If there's any one person, like if Srivas Pandit Prabhu is sinister and he decides, I'm actually going to change it, then the whole thing is lost, right? Then forget it. It's finished. In fact, Ravana is defeating Ram and the whole thing becomes messed up, right? So that's how we normally think of oral transmission, as something that's unreliable and that's constantly in flux. And most of the time, we're right. Most of the time, we're right. Oral transmission is very unreliable, except when it comes to the Vedas. The Vedas were passed down so precisely over thousands of years that scholars today say that the recitation of the Vedas that we have today, you know, you've all heard it before. Om Sahasrishirsha Purusha Sahasraksha Sahasrapak. That recitation that we have is the closest thing we have to a 3,000-year-old tape recording, right? Now, that's a significant thing coming from scholars who tend to be pretty skeptical about the faithfulness of things over time, right? But they're willing to say, even though we don't actually have tape recordings, but just seeing the method of transmission as we find it today and whatever written records we have to corroborate that translation, that it's the closest thing we have to a 3,000-year-old tape recording. That's significant. That's amazing. How do you transmit thousands and thousands of mantras in a method of recitation and do it perfectly without any little change over such a large period of time? The answer is that there were a variety of different techniques that the Vedic reciters used to ensure the fidelity and the accuracy of the transmission without actually writing it down. The first thing they did was that everything in the Vedas is in verse, is in meter, just like we have in the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, this may seem like a given to us, an obvious thing, but it's not. The vast majority of literature in the world is written in prose, that is straight lines across, right? But practically all of our literature is written in verse. And verse means that there's a certain rhythm to it, a pattern. We'll define verse more carefully later in the seminar. But there's a certain rhythm or pattern which you use to recite it. And that rhythm or pattern, that metrical rhythm, does something very, very important. What is the usefulness of meter? What happens when you put something in a rhythmic pattern? It's easy to memorize, right? It's easy to memorize. You've had this experience before. If you have a tune with a nice rhythm or beat to it, you struggle to get it out of your head sometimes, right? You accidentally heard it in the radio or on the PA system in some shopping center, and there it is, and it's stuck, right? On the other hand, if you try to just memorize a paragraph for a drama or a play, it's so difficult. What's the next line? What's the next verse, right? But as soon as you put it into a rhythm, it's memorizable, okay? So the first thing was metrical. So I'm just going to keep a list here. So meter is the first thing, okay? The second thing that they did is that every syllable, every cluster of letters in each verse is assigned a particular pitch. Either three different pitches are possible in Vedic Sanskrit: an upper, lower, or middle pitch. Udatta, anudatta, or swarita. And that pitch, what it does is it creates essentially a melody. A melody that is, again, very easy to memorize and to understand. It's, Hare Krishna Prabhu, welcome. It's very easy to memorize and to understand. And it creates a melodic pattern. Again, as soon as you have melody from one in a verse, in a song, that makes it so much easier to understand and to listen to and to memorize. With a song, for example, right? Namaste Narasingha. We may not understand the metrical pattern, but because we sing it, we pick it up much, much easier. These three pitches you can hear in Vedic recitation even today. When we do that, Om Sahasra Shirsha Purusha Sahasraksh, that's not random. Each one of those pitches is specifically assigned to a particular letter. It's not the way we sing melodies when we recite Bhagavatam verses. You can sing it in different ways, right? And we all use different melodies when we recite the verse. But when we do Vedic recitation, it's specifically each syllable is assigned a specific pitch, either upper, lower, or middle. And when you write Vedic knowledge, then it's Vedic verses, each one is marked with an accent mark to demonstrate which pitch you have to use. Those three original pitches, by the time you get to the Samaveda, those are expanded to five, right? Now, you remember in how in Bhagavatam it's described that Krishna is praised by the singers of the Samaveda, Samaga, right? And this is supposed to be something that's very, very beautiful and very nice, is this to be praised by the songs of the Samaveda. And the reason for that is that increase from three to five pitches makes for a much broader melodic pattern, so that it's much more beautiful to listen to than even the usual Vedic recitation that we hear. We don't often hear Samaveda recitation done publicly, although there are still some people who can do that. Those five pitches were eventually expanded over time to become eight, to give us the octave. And the octave, Sa Re Ga Ma Pa Da Ni Sa, that we are all familiar with. It's part of Indian music and Western music as well. So Vedic recitation was essentially the birth of Indian music. And Indian music became one of the most extensive and sophisticated musical traditions in the world. And it all began with this simple three-part recitation of the different pitches of the Vedas. Okay? So the question is, how do you ensure accuracy of preservation over thousands of years just through oral transmission? First, by giving it a metrical pattern. Second, by assigning a pitch to it. Thirdly, they would always they would recite in specific patterns of recitation. Patterns means that not only could they recite the Vedic mantras forwards, but also practically in every other way, forwards and backwards, inside and out, in different combinations. So, for example, if you have four letters, A, B, C, D, sorry, four words in the Sanskrit, A, B, C, and D, and then normally you would just recite it left to right. But in Vedic recitations, there are different kinds of parthas, krama partha, jatha partha, and in some of them, you would recite it in combinations where you go back one step, A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, and in this way, create kind of a weave, even more complicated patterns, create a weave of the words, so that you literally know the work forward and backwards, inside and out. Just like that famous line from Hamlet, to be or not to be, that is the question. It has a metrical pattern to it. It's in something called iambic pentameter. It has a meter to it. You could probably sing it in some way. But try reciting that in a pattern. Try to be or not to be, that is the question. Try doing that backwards, for example. Question the... is the... Anyway, I'm already confused. But it's difficult, right? It's very tough. And these Brahmins could do that literally with the mantras of the Vedas, so that there's no chance of accidentally losing even a syllable. Every word of these texts is crucial. And fourth, okay, so meter, pitch, patterns, and then physical movements were added to it as well. So especially when the teacher is teaching the student how to recite and teaching the specific Vedic mantras, he will teach the student to move the head and the hands in a particular direction to match the various pitches to aid in memorization, right? So moving the head, Om Sahasrashirsha Purusha Sahasraksha Sahasrapat, like that. So that when you're actually doing it, may I touch you? Okay. Om Sahasrashirsha Purusha Sahasraksha. So what that does is it creates a physical dimension to the memory, a physical dimension. Now, that's crucial. That's very powerful, because physical memory runs deeper than intellectual memory only. Think about this, right? You memorize a verse, you don't use it for a while, you struggle to remember it again, you forget it. But what if you park your car at the airport, go to India for 3 months, never drive a car there, come back 3 months later, and you get into your car? Do you worry that you have forgotten how to drive it? No. What if you spend a year without riding a bike? The next time you get on a bike, do you worry that you may not know how to ride it? No. Even if it's a clutch or a manual, which you haven't driven for years, even then, you get there and you know what to do, right? Our physical memory runs deeper than our brain memory, right? Than our intellectual memory. And so by adding a physical dimension to our to the recitation of the Vedas, it creates a memory that is much deeper, and you're less likely to forget what you have learned. The final thing that they did to ensure the accuracy of the oral transmission is to recite in groups, together. Now, you can occasionally recite Vedas on your own, in your own home. But whenever possible, the Brahmins used to get together in groups to recite. And so effective this is, because if you've done all of this work and you've studied and read for all these years and you've memorized everything, if one person gets one syllable wrong, everyone knows, right? Everyone's going to turn and go, what is this Brahmin doing here? Non-qualified, get him out, right? So the group activity, the group pressure is crucial to doing that kind of thing, right? Maybe another heat wave announcement or something. We arrived on the flight, we landed, and the flight attendant said, you can now use your mobile phones. So everyone turned on their mobile phones, and the whole plane was going, beep, 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 including the flight attendants, and she was on the PA system. So it was, the whole plane was going, it sounded like an emergency, but it was the heat alert for San Jose, so... Anyway, so the group recitation. Now, here's one aside, right? That these systems were so effective that they preserved for thousands of years an oral transmission so accurately that scholars can say that we have a 3,000-year-old tape recording today. If they're so effective back then, they're still effective now. And so when we're, for example, learning verses, memorizing verses, if we can use as many of these different techniques available to us, there's a greater chance that those verses will stick in our memory and we'll keep them for a long time, right? So, for example, understanding the metrical pattern of the verse and reciting it with a real sense of rhythm. A lot of the verses we memorize, you can tap dance to those verses. They've got such a clear metrical pattern. Feeling that metrical pattern in you as you recite it aids in the process of memorization. Similarly, singing those verses rather than just speaking them in a monotone helps to memorize as well. The patterns one, I don't know, frankly, whether we can do Sarvadharman Parityajya backwards or not, but maybe a little too much for our times. Physical movements, again, studies have shown that memory is much stronger if we memorize the same thing in different contexts and different places. So if you always memorize your verses in one place in your house, you're less likely to remember it when you're outside of that one place. But if you practice that verse in your living room and then in your car and then in the temple room, and then in a preaching program that you've gone to outside, that verse is going to be much more accessible because the brain essentially has created multiple pathways to that same object, multiple pathways that are location-driven. And so physical movement, where we are physically located, the space that we're in affects our memory very much. And this is also true in the reverse. If you're really struggling to remember something, like your, I don't know, where you put your keys or anything like that, or even a little fact of information, go back to the place where you last remembered it. And you're likely to access that information much faster. Okay? And finally, verses happen they come to us much easier if we learn them as a group, if we recite them as a group. I think most of us, for example, have never actually sat down and memorized Namaste, Narasinghaya, Prahladala, right? It's just something that by the time you've come to the temple for the 10th time, you just know, right? It's one of the fastest and easiest verses to things to learn. The drawback of that also is that you also pick up and maintain a lot of the mispronunciations that you hear as well. So the oral transmission is good so long as the person or the community that's reciting it is doing it accurately, and then you're likely to learn it as well. But sometimes that gets messed up. But group recitation is always, or even with two or three people, is going to aid in memorization. Okay? So using these five techniques, the Vedas were passed down so precisely over so many centuries, millennia, with no change whatsoever. In fact, they were passed down more precisely than writing ever could. Sometimes We think of writing as a stable means of transmission, and oral transmission, as we've already discussed, as an unstable, unreliable means. But writing, in fact, is very, very unstable. And this form of memorization is more stable than writing itself. Here's why. If you think of the time before the printing press and before copy machines, how would you acquire a written book? If you wanted a copy of Srimad Bhagavatam, how would you get it? It would be in a palm leaf manuscript, and you would need to get that manuscript copied, right? Probably instead of you copying it by hand, simply because most people were not very expert at writing, you would probably get someone else, you would hire someone to write it for you, a scribe. Okay? This is true of both rich and poor, learned and illiterate. People hired someone to write for them. Writing was considered a manual skill that you specialized in, but was not really necessary for everyone to know. You would hire the king, for example, didn't need to write, right? Just like, why would a king fix his own plumbing? Would he fix his own plumbing? If the sink is leaking, he'd hire a plumber, right? We hire plumbers to come and fix it. And if that's your job, that's what you do. You don't need to know that much plumbing, right? In the same way, the king didn't need to, or a nobleman, or Nanda Maharaj, didn't need to know how to write. He could always hire someone to write for him. Writing was not considered such a glorious thing. You'd hire a scribe. The scribe copies from another manuscript that you have access to onto a blank palm leaf or bark or homemade paper or something like that, and you copy into it and gives you your copy. However, in the process of copying, many different mistakes are introduced. Many different mistakes from one to the other. Copy. When children read, you see them do this sometimes. If they're looking up and then they look away, they come back, and it's called eye skip. There's a word, say it says tomato up here, and two lines down it says tomato. They'll skip from that tomato to this word tomato and miss the lines in between. They're not actually paying attention to whether it makes sense or not. They're just reading because they're told to read. In the same way, these scribes were paid to write, they were often illiterate themselves. The scribes often didn't know what they were writing. They couldn't actually read. It was an artistic endeavor for them. They were like photocopy machines. Even if they did know how to write, to read, they didn't care. They weren't interested in trying to figure out the details. Scribes were paid how? Based on the number of books they translate, write down, right? Number of pages. You're probably paid per page or per book. That means the more pages you copy, the more books you copy, the more you get paid, and you have a family to feed, right? And so that means the faster you do it, the more money you make, right? It's like taxi drivers. The faster you drive, the more rides you get, and so on. So they're doing as fast as they can. That means with speed comes greater chances of accidents happening and them missing words, missing lines, making mistakes. They finish it up, give it to you. By the time you discover those missed lines or something is wrong or it doesn't make sense, they're already gone. You paid them and they've gone, right? So the point is that many, many mistakes were introduced in this way. When I was working on the Sandarbhas of Jiva Goswami, part of my task was to create a critical edition of one of the Sandarbhas. A critical edition means an edition that takes the different manuscripts, handwritten texts out there, and compares them to see what the differences are and tries to reconstruct what the original is. Most of the differences you can easily identify as mistakes. It's not difficult. There's some cases where you have to take an educated guess. But as I was doing that, I was comparing maybe 4 or 5 different manuscripts. And pretty soon it became very clear that 2 of those manuscripts went together because one of them was directly copied from the other. Here's why. One of those manuscripts used to do something very odd. It would go on with the text, and then occasionally it would jump back to something I had already read and repeat a few words and then get back to the right place and continue. And I didn't know why that repetition was happening until I looked to see this other manuscript and realized that this is what was happening. This manuscript that he was copying from was written kind of like this. Okay? Now, apparently this scribe had difficulties writing in a straight line, which I had difficulties doing as well. Still have difficulties writing in a straight line, unless I have lined paper. How you become a scribe and can't write in a straight line, I don't know. This is supposed to be your job. But apparently this scribe couldn't. Maybe it was someone like me doing it homegrown, right? But here's what was happening. The other scribe would go like this, and copy, 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 copy down here, okay? Copy, get to the end of the line. His page wasn't finished. It was a little longer. He'd get to the end of the line like this, and then go to the next line. This is the next. Oh, sorry, this is the same line. And so he would copy some of it, then realize that it was the same line and move to the next. Do this again, come back to the next line, start copying, go, oops, this is the same line, and then move down to the third. And so at this marker, there was always some repetition. The only thing was he never bothered to scratch it out or to cut it out or to indicate in any way. And these are permanent, right? When you're writing, likhati in Sanskrit, the word for writing, in Hindi also, likhna. In Sanskrit, likhati is the word for writing, and it literally means to scratch. Because what you're doing is you're scratching into the surface of the palm leaf or the bark, and creating a little scratch in which the ink then falls, it goes, right? So it's permanent. You can scratch on top of it, but there's no erasing it. And scratching on top was apparently too much time, and so he just left it. Many other problems can happen as well, besides eye skip and besides these types of things. But essentially what happens is if a person is not careful, over time the text can be changed in significant ways. This is why writing has never been as reliable as we think it is. We think, oh, if you want to remember, you have to write it down. But historically speaking, writing, different versions of the Vedas were introduced after they started to be written down, not before. The Vedic oral transmission was so perfect, orally speaking, it's when people decided that they couldn't memorize it anymore because Kali Yuga memories get shorter and shorter. You start to write it down and you start to get different recensions or different versions of the Vedas. And that creates differences. Now, just to allay any fears, I should tell you that some texts are more susceptible to this than others. And with Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, which are our two main scriptures, their manuscript tradition is incredibly stable. I think in my Glories of Srimad Bhagavatam seminar, I mentioned this already, that with Bhagavatam, you find very, very few alterations and changes, despite the fact that it's being passed down for many, many centuries. Okay? So we don't have to worry too much that there's... You can find some slight variations in Bhagavad Gita as well, but they're nothing major. Just like even when Srila Prabhupada, right, he recites this verse, Janma Karma Chame Divyam. And then what does he say? Yo Janati Tatvataha, right? And if you read the verse in the books, it says, Evam Yo veti tatvatha, right? And Prabhupada says, yo janati tatvatha. Now, veti and janati are synonyms in Sanskrit. Both know to know. One who knows me in truth. So, there's nothing lost there. But there's an example. And in fact, when the acharyas write their commentaries on Bhagavatam or Gita, part of their task is to let the reader know the variants, the variant readings that are present. So, if they know that some manuscripts use this word instead of that word, Mukti Pade Sadaya Bhak rather than Bhakti Pade Sadaya Bhak, they will let the reader know that this alteration, this variation is present, right? So what I mean to say is that this is not a scandalous piece of information I'm giving you. The Acharyas are very comfortable with this idea that human error can introduce various changes, especially within written tradition. But the point is, this is what makes the Vedic tradition so great, is because these changes and differences were avoided as long as the Vedas were passed down orally. The takeaway point is that we should not we underestimate the power of oral recitation and oral learning. We come from a tradition, from a history, from an oral culture. This is Vedic culture. This is our heritage as Vaishnavas, is we have a line of learning that is oral in nature. And we today live in a society and in a culture which is much more visual in nature. Right? The eyes, if you're blind, you're going to have a lot more trouble in our society today than if you're deaf. Because everything is visual in nature. We read visually, we learn visually, we charts and pictures and so on. But in Vedic culture, and that's not too long ago, even, you know, 500-600 years ago, the focus on orality was very strong, very powerful. Even a concept like darshan, right? We say, let's go have darshan of the deities. So darshan is fundamentally a visual act, you see. But if you look at the murtis of Krishna and Lord Vishnu and so on from ancient times, they were often very non-detailed. Right? If you look at old murtis, they're often very non-detailed. And when you go to have darshan in these old temples, you barely see anything. Right? And yet for the devotees, it was as powerful of a darshan experience as we have today with our murtis that are much more in detail carved. The reason is that not because they were any less good at carving. I mean, the evidence shows that the artistry back then was even better than it is today when they wanted to do it. But the reality is that for most people, it did not matter. You really did have darshan of the Lord through your ears more than through your eyes, right? The culture is very much an oral culture. And this is why we say that it's a transcendental sound vibration. Even though these books are still now written down, we still stick to this idea of sound vibration, because that is where it's essentially at, is it's an oral culture. In this seminar, we're not going to be talking about writing in Sanskrit at all, the script. Even though today people think of Devanagari, you know, those nice letters with the line on top, they think of it as Sanskrit. That's what Sanskrit is, to be able to read that. But that script, I don't know if you realize, is actually very recent. It's not very old, I mean, comparatively speaking. It's only a few hundred years old, Devanagari script. It's not ancient. There are much more ancient scripts that are there, like Brahmi, for example, during Ashoka's time, 2,000 years ago. But the point is, the script has always been changing. Every part of India writes Sanskrit literature in their own script. Bengalis write it in Bengali script, and Telugu people write it in Telugu script, and Tamil people write it in Tamil script. Everyone does it on their own. So there's nothing particularly sacred about the letters as they are written, about the orthography. It's the sounds that are powerful, right? When we say that Sanskrit is a Devavani, the language of the demigods, that's referring to the sound vibration, not to the actual orthography or the letters. And therefore, writing Sanskrit in Roman letters, in Latin letters, like we do, A, B, C, D, E, like that, is perfectly legitimate. Right? There's nothing sacrilegious, there's nothing weak about reading Sanskrit in those letters, because people have been doing that, using their own native scripts for Sanskrit for centuries. The key is just to pronounce it well, because it's all in the sound vibration. Now, the final question I want to raise in regard to the Vedas is why? Why were they doing this incredible feat to memorize everything so precisely so that it's transmitted perfectly over thousands of years? Why go through this effort? You know, to do this kind of task with thousands of mantras, It's not easy. And it used to take someone a lifetime to learn. This is why a whole class of people, namely the Brahmins, spent their whole life doing just this. Okay? And if they, every Brahmin was expected to memorize one of the Vedas. If by chance they were able to memorize two, then they received the title Dwivedi, right? Or Trivedi. Or in India, you can even find people with last names Chaturvedi, right? And they don't even know what Veda is, but their last name is Chaturvedi, right? Or Trivedi, right? So it was a tough job to do. Why? Why waste, in quotation marks, the energies of a whole class of people to memorize all of this stuff, right? Precisely. The reason for it is that with the Vedas, something particular is happening. It's not just what the Vedas mean that give them their power. It's what the actual sound of the Vedas, the mantras, in their precise lettering, which gives them their power. Essentially, the Vedas create a spiritual technology that allows these mantras to change the world around us through the proper recitation of sound. These mantras are what scholars call effective speech or effective language. You see, there's different kinds of language. There's descriptive language, like if I say, oh, it's a very warm day outside. My words don't actually make it a warm day. It's just a description of what's actually the case outside. But occasionally, speech will have the power to change something in the world, to affect something in the world. So, suppose, for example, you're in a courtroom and you're the accused party and it's time for sentencing and the judge stands there and he says, I sentence you to 6 months in prison. Boom, boom, right? Now, those words, I sentence you to six months in prison, have just changed your life, right? That's effective speech. It has the power to change something in the world. But effective speech, in order to happen, requires a very specific set of circumstances. Suppose I sit here and I say, Srivas Prabhu, I sentence you to 6 months in prison. Right? Now, people laughed, right? No one got upset. Now, why not? Why didn't that change anything in the world? You're still sitting here free. Why? What was missing? I'm not the judge, right? That's point number one. I'm not a judge, okay? So let's change the scenario a little bit. Let's say there is a judge from the California High Court, and he's walking along and goes to Starbucks and it takes too long to get his coffee. So when he finally gets his coffee, he looks at the server and says, I'm sick of this. I sentence you to 6 months in prison. Right? Will she go to prison? No. It's a judge, right? Why not then? What's missing? The location isn't there, right? It's not the right context. It's not a courtroom. Suppose he drags that server into a courtroom, sits her down, and there hits the gavel and says, I sentence you. Will she go to prison then? Yes. Still not, right? Why not? What's missing? She's not a criminal. She didn't commit a crime, right? She's not the proper recipient of a sentence. There's no lawyers. There's no defense happened. It's not in the context of any laws, right? The point being that in order for that to be effective speech, I sentence you to 6 months in prison, there needs to be a vast set of circumstances that are precisely correct, and then it happens. The same thing is true of Vedic mantras. Srila Prabhupada tells us that it is not possible to do Vedic sacrifices today in Kali Yuga. And you can say, well, why not? I saw my friend do it. You know, or they did it on TV in India. The reason is just because you're a judge, you're a Brahmin, just because you've got the fire and you've got ghee and stuff like that, is not going to make it effective speech. Those mantras are not going to be powerful, effective. Because unless there's a whole set of circumstances that come together from a very, very precise form of recitation using these five different mechanisms, unless there's the sacrificial altar that is measured precisely and carefully according to a set of guidelines. You know that the Vedic altar was arranged in a highly precise and measured way. And so careful were they in measuring that and arranging it, that gave birth, the measurements of the Vedic sacrificial altar gave birth to the science of geometry in India. And you may know this from other study that in India, mathematics became very advanced very quickly, very early on. It came not from numbers, but from geometry, from Vedic geometry that gradually developed into the whole science of mathematics, right? So when we say Vedic culture is very great, this is what we're talking about, right? Music, mathematics, ritual, mantras, vibrate, all of that is there. Memorization, writing, all of this is born as a result of the Vedic tradition. When all those circumstances are precisely in place, the Vedic sacrificial altar, the mantras, a qualified brahmana, the right circumstances, the right yajamana, the recipient, right, the person being sentenced, that are benefited as a result of the sacrifice. All of those things are in place, then we can hope that those Vedic mantras, pronounced precisely, every little letter and word, right, if the judge gets one thing wrong in the wording of the sentence, that sentence can be thrown out, right? It's going to be ineffective. If you get one letter wrong in the recitation of the Vedic mantra, this can be a catastrophe. You remember the story of Tvashta and Vritrasura and Vishwarupa in Bhagavatam, right? Tvashta is pronouncing these mantras, doing this yajna to kill Indra, because Indra has killed his son, Vishwarupa. And when he does this, then at the final point, when there's the time for the Purnahuti, the final offering into the fire, he says, Indra Shatro Vivardhaswa. Indra Shatro Vivardhaswa. Now this word Indra Shatru is a compound word. Okay, Indra Shatru, it's two words put together. Indra, the killer of Indra, or that's what he intended. But depending on whether you put the high mark, Udatta, on the word Indra or on the word Shatru, the word killer, it changes the meaning. It makes it either killer of Indra or he who is killed by Indra. One who has Indra as his killer. And I don't remember which is which, and this is why I never do Vedic sacrifices, because you get the wrong result. But one of them gives killer of Indra. He did the opposite. He did, oh, you who will be killed by Indra, arise from the fire. And so we got this fearsome, dangerous-looking demon with copper-red eyes and red hair and all of this, who had a heart of a devotee and so soft, and finally tells Indra and says, look, you're supposed to kill me. Please kill me. Get this done with. I want to go back to Godhead, and you can go on with your material life. And let's... Because this was the prediction, right? This was the prediction. So that's the Vedic chanting. So powerful and so dangerous, right? So dangerous. Now, in this context, you can understand that when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Namna Makari Bahudha Nija Sarva Shaktis Tatrarpita Niyamita Smarane Nakalaha. Why that is such a powerful and major, significant statement, right? When he says that in the chanting of Krishna's holy names, there is no worry about time or place or the quality of the speaker or the quality of the hearer or any of that. It doesn't matter whether you're a Brahman or a Shudra, man or a woman, or clean, pure, or impure. You can chant Krishna's holy names and it will be effective. Think of that. That means that you are giving the power to say you are sentenced to 6 months in prison and removing the necessity of having a judge, a courtroom, lawyers, and the law, anything, right? You're giving the power of effective speech to anyone and everyone. Why? Because it's Krishna's holy names. And therefore, the normal rules that apply to mantra chanting do not matter. Thank God for that, right? If we had the situation of that tvashta, right, where if you put the accent on a Hare instead of Krishna, right, you might go to the spiritual world or to hell. Who knows? You know, we could be chanting together and you could go to back to God and I'd go to hell because I put the accent in the wrong place, right? So Krishna is very kind in that he gets rid of that. But you can imagine why in Mahaprabhu's time this was such a controversial thing, right? We know in Navadvip, when this whole Chandkazi incident happened, it wasn't just the Muslims complaining about the chanting, right? It was the Hindus, the Brahmins complaining, saying he is polluting Krishna's name. He is polluting the Vedic mantras. Are Krishna's names, are they not greater than the Vedic mantras? Yes. Yes? So if the Vedic mantras require all of this, then how can you chant Krishna's name like this? Are you not committing a great offense? Are you not doing something dangerous? Are you not polluting it? Their argument was a very legitimate one from the Vedic standpoint, right? And this is why this is such a radical step that Mahaprabhu and other Vaishnava Acharyas do. You know the story of Ramanujacharya also when he gets up on the top of the temple tower and tells everyone, Om Namo Narayanaya, right? Right? It's a radical step, and he is threatened with hell as a result of taking that step. And this is why, right? This is why. The effectivity, you have the same effectiveness, if not greater effectiveness, than the Vedic mantras, and yet you're getting rid of all the controlling mechanisms and the things that allow it to be limited in its power, right? If judges were not limited in their power by context, they could terrorize the world, right? But they're limited, right? In certain circumstances is only when they can exercise their power. We get the ability to exercise this great power of the Mahamantra anywhere and everywhere, right? Anywhere and everywhere. And this is why it is with this background then that Srila Prabhupada, when he says, just one line of my books can change a person's life. And one might look at that and wonder, well, how? Right? What if the line you read is, thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purports of the sixth? Is that going to change your life? You might be skeptical, right? But in this context, you understand why. Because it's effective speech, the power of the mantra. Essentially what Prabhupada is saying, that every line of his books is basically mantra. Just like the verses themselves, but also now the English and the purports is mantra. And therefore, in contact with mantra, that's effective speech. Your life will be changed. Because we've removed all the controlling features on it, and now each line becomes effective, like that judge offering a sentence. It can change someone's life when you read it. Okay? So this is the context, this is the background. Prabhupada's statement that one line can change your books is not merely a statement of confidence in the quality of the books. It's something that has a long heritage in powerful sound vibration going all the way back to the Vedic times. Okay? So we could speak more about the Vedas and things like that, but I want to pause at this point and see if you have any questions that deal particularly with this Vedic heritage and tradition. Vaisheshika Prabhu? We have a mic here.
In the context of effective speech, and you were mentioning how much the entire scene has to be set for that to be effective, how is it that we find throughout the Bhagavad that sages walk around seemingly, sometimes indiscriminately, cursing people. In fact, it seems curses seem to be the main catalyst for anything happening in the Bhagavatam. How are they so effective, and what is the context of their effective speech? Yes.
So, thank you. That's a good question. Actually, the topic of curses in Bhagavatam is just really fascinating. I've created this whole table, this chart. This is just for fun, of different categorizing different kinds of curses in Bhagavatam. There's the curse that's mainly meant for punishment of someone's wrongdoing, like their karma. There's curses that are preemptive curses. That is, they're preventing someone from doing something wrong. There are some curses that are merely predictive curses. It's going to happen anyway, but they just give a curse to make sure it happens, or, you know, to facilitate it. Who was it? Mahaprabhu was cursed, right? That your material life is going to be finished. Anyway, he's going to take sannyas, right? But it's just facilitating what is going to happen anyway. So anyway, there's something like four or five different categories of curses, and then different reasons they happen, the different types of recipients that you find them, and so on. So it's a really fun topic, actually, the curses. But back to the question, which is the effectiveness. There's certain amounts of limited speech that apparently the power and the purity of the person delivering them, who has already performed his Vedic yajnas and all of that, and Vedic mantras separately, the power and purity of the individual is sufficient to make them effective, right? So the point is, these Brahmins who are giving the curses, like Durvasa Muni, cannot get the results of a Vedic sacrifice without the whole arena. But certain very limited types of speech they can do just as a result of their own purity. So the ability to sentence someone, literally speaking, to hell is actually a very minor aspect of their power, right? Just like a judge, even outside the courtroom, has certain limited forms of privilege that he or she is able to wield. For example, if they get stopped by a cop, then there may be some leeway there in terms of whether or not he gets a ticket, or, you know, in certain contexts, legal contexts, they may be able to waive certain rules and stuff like that. So those limited privileges that come with being a judge or a policeman or whatever, in any context, they carry with them. But the major functions of their job, which are actually the Vedic sacrificial arena, they can't do that outside that particular context. This is why in the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, the sages are looking for a better solution, right? They've been 1,000 years, they've been doing these Vedic sacrifices, their bodies are black with soot, and they're not seeing the results they want to. And so their particular question is, given the fact that this elaborate context is not going to be feasible a few hundred years from now, we really do need to find another means of getting that same effectiveness, or even better effectiveness than what we have with these sacrifices. Okay. Good. Other questions? Yes.
It's on. Hare Krishna. So my question is, the person who's chanting Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, he has done all the sacrificial offerings in his past life, and he's almost carrying a very heavy amount of Sukriti at his back pocket. With that person definitely gets empowered to curse somebody. So it's like a devotee's, like, they are very empowered in with regards to, so can they be considered equivalent of the Rishi Munis at that time, and whatever they say, why sometime it doesn't get true?
Yes, you see, that's a good question. The ability to curse is not a spiritual power. It's merely a subtle technology. It's when you have a certain level of purity, this is not necessarily spiritual advancement, but purity of character, you have developed some Brahma Tejas or some power as a result of that purity and austerity in practice, you develop the ability to curse, okay, or levitate, or fly in the air, or do so many different things as a result of that yogic power. These are all subtle technologies. They're spiritual technologies that you just need to be trained as in a particular way over many years, and then you can learn how to do it. As devotees, even advanced devotees, we are not trained in how to deliver curses or to do other levitate or to fly in the sky. We could be, but from a devotee's perspective, that's not very useful knowledge. Right? That's not very useful information. Because from a devotee's perspective, if a devotee is hurt or dissatisfied or insulted in some way, Krishna anywhere, anyway, takes care of it, right? He takes Vaishnava Aparad more seriously than any curse could potentially give to anyone. And the best example is the story of Ambarish and Durvasa, right? Durvasa, as a Brahmin, had learned the technology of cursing and used it effectively. Ambarish Maharaj, as non-Brahmin but still a devotee, did not know that technology, and yet, in the end, he was more effective as a result of Krishna's protection, because Krishna takes Vaishnava Aparad so seriously, right? So, for that reason, devotees are generally not interested in knowing this. They are not aggressive by nature, so the idea of cursing someone is in any case not very tasteful. In some cases, they will use it if this is their background, right? Narada Muni is an accomplished Brahman, an accomplished yogi. He has that technology. He uses it as a devotee to help others, like Nalkuver and Manigriva, right? But Ambarish Maharaj is not, right? So the point is that if we have it, fine, but as devotees, we don't aspire for such technologies, because we understand, okay, Krishna takes care, right? And he'll look after us as needed. Yes, Prabhu.
Hari Bol, Prabhuji. So Prabhuji, at the start of the lecture, you were saying that there are Vedic mantras, then there is Bhagavat mantras. Why did you make this distinction when both are Vedas? Why making that distinction? Yeah.
Yeah, so Vedic mantras, the intent was Vedic mantras versus Krishna's holy names, right? So the point is that the Bhagavata's mantras, the Gita's mantras are just as effective as the Vedic mantras, except the contextual, the circumstantial aspects of it are removed, right? You don't need all the setup and the technology in order to get their effectiveness, because they're essentially Krishna Katha. They're Krishna Nam, right? And as a result of their direct contact with Krishna, you don't need the courthouse and the laws and the lawyers and the judge, right? You can just have the sound vibration and it'll be effective in its own right. Okay, so that's the difference between the Vedic mantras and the literatures that we read, that they are Krishna Katha, they're driven, their power is driven by Krishna Nam, right? Bhagavatam says that in every anupadam, in every word of Bhagavatam, Krishna is present. So therefore there is no extra need for any context or technological arrangement. This is what the Vedas are. They are spiritual technology. And like any kind of technological application, you need a very precise application of that technology, otherwise it can get dangerous, right? The more powerful the technology, the more precision you need. I mean, if you write computer code, you know, right, that if you get one little thing wrong in that code, and you can go on an endless loop and your whole thing crashes. Just one little thing. If you're running nuclear technology and your precision is off by, you know, 100 meters, instead of, forget nuclear, any bomb, instead of destroying the enemy target, you can end up destroying a school. Right, so with any technology, precision is of the utmost importance. So the Vedas are essentially a spiritual technology. But when you come to the Bhagavat level or Krishna Katha level, then all of that precision requirements are removed. Of course, if you do it nicely, the effectivity will be increased. We'll talk about that a little later. But it's not crucial. You're not going to risk a dangerous situation by chanting Krishna's name when you haven't showered, for example, right? Whereas with the Vedas, you can risk it. Yes, Prabhu.
So, Prabhuji, a quick question on the scribe and the original, the manuscript, because I know there is one of my friends, he showed me that Banaras Hindu University has kept the most original manuscript of the Vedic scriptures in the entire world. So they have, which Madan Malviya has set up this institute. So is there a way that if there is any error, let's say
there could be 100 copies. So there is the original one, we can still validate if there is a disagreement between multiple, you know, copies. So there is always going back to the original, at least to revalidate that there is the accuracy of the particular scriptures or verses. So what is your comment on the original script preservation as well as the revalidation of the, you know, any error?
So scholars work on critical editions of different types of books, and there have been critical editions done of different Puranas and things like that. But with our Srimad Bhagavatam, with the BBT version of Srimad Bhagavatam, this is based on the edition that Srila Prabhupada used, which was an edition he used several, but one important source of the BBT edition is one published in Ahmedabad by Krishna Shankar Shastri with the commentaries of about 10 or 12 different acharyas. Now, the reason I mention that is because when you have commentaries from the acharyas, then that provides an independent source of verification that the text is accurate. Because as I was mentioning earlier, they will, in their commentaries, point out any possible variations in the readings of the texts, if there are significant variations. So when we rely on Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's version, the version he wrote a commentary on, and we know what version because the acharyas repeat every third word, practically speaking, in their commentaries. It's like a word for word and purport combined. We can rest assured that that edition is the one that acharyas were using for centuries, right? So if it's good enough for them, essentially it's good enough for us, right? That's the basic point. Now, one could go back theoretically and try to find very, very old manuscripts and compare and so on. And there has been a critical edition done of Bhagavatam, but in terms of, I've read the critical edition side by side, not all of it, but good chunks of it, side by side with the BBT edition, and the differences are negligible. They're very, very little and almost never affect the meaning at all, right? So that Krishna Shankar Shastri edition with the multiple acharyas commentaries is actually, for most scholars, regard that as a more reliable text than even the critical edition, because the critical edition has been reconstructed by contemporary scholars, whereas the Krishna Shankar Shastri's edition is the one that has been accepted by acharyas starting from Sridhar Swami at the earliest, so 13th century all the way down now. So we can be very confident about the quality of the text of the BBT edition. And I have found next to no differences between the BBT edition and Krishna Shankar Shastri. So the Bhagavatam we have in the BBT books is essentially the one that everyone relies upon.
So, Prabhu, one of the charges that's been levied against us is that Mahaprabhu changed the wording. From originally it was Hare Rama, and then, you know, he changed it. How do you specifically as a scholar answer that? Because the validity has changed. From our perspective, we know that Krishna can change and the names are powerful, but just a little bit more light on you twisting the mantras and just why it was done and what was the context, and does it, to a layman, how can we say that it still doesn't change the efficacy of the mantra? So.
Yes. So this is exactly the crucial difference between Vedic mantra and Krishna Naam, right? Krishna's holy names. Is that if you did that with the Purusha Sukta, it would be a big problem, right? It would be a big problem. You would lose efficacy, things would go wrong, it's not good. But when you, with Krishna's holy names, right, then it essentially, that change, when done by an authorized personality like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is not going to affect the efficacy or its power. It's going to be the exact same thing, in fact. And of course, we know that if we continuously chant Krishna's name, Kirtaniya Sadahari, the Hare Krishna mantra, then whether one comes first or one comes second is not possible to figure out, right? So from Mahaprabhu's perspective, who is doing Kirtaniya Sada Hari and the Mahamantra is rotating 24/7 within his heart, then which line is first and which line is second in a circle is going to be irrelevant, right? But that is an example of the difference between the Vedic mantras and Krishna's holy names. Yes.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. I had a question regarding variants. So sometimes when we go for, let's say, preaching, and sometimes we quote a verse thinking that, you know, it will feel more authorized, the audience. And someone is more learned, let's say, or he has read other version of Bhagavad Gita, and he says that, okay, this verse is actually this. You know, like for example, Yo Evam, or in Sarva Dharma also there is some. So that time what one should say or react, especially if there is a bigger audience, not just one-to-one.
So you're saying people actually bring up variants in the Sanskrit or differences in how we interpret, how we understand the verse?
No, in the Sanskrit verse itself.
Really? Okay. So when that sort of thing happens, then we have to show them Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, the Sanskrit, and say that this text is accepted very, very widely as the original text of the Gita. I mean, the thing is, with the Sanskrit for the Gita and the Bhagavatam and Ishopanishad, there's not much debate. I mean, even the Mayavadis in general accept the same text of the Gita. It's in the interpretation that there is disagreement. But the text itself, if they want to argue that the actual text is different, then the onus is on them to prove that their version is correct, because this version is the one that has been used by acharyas from the time of Shankaracharya in the 9th century and even before, right? So essentially the point is, well, if you feel that this text is not correct, then show me why. Show me where your source is and what manuscript tradition you're drawing this alternate reading from. If it's a variation like Evam Yo Veti or Yo Janati, it makes no difference because it means exactly the same thing, right?
It was actually smaller only. It was like Aham Tva and Aham Tvam. So it's just that sometimes if there are larger audience, they will. So that's why.
Yeah. So you ask them, you say, what is the difference in meaning between Aham Tva and Aham Tvam? And if the meaning is significant, then you say, look, this is the edition that everyone accepts in. You need to tell me what manuscript history this other version comes from. If the meaning is not, difference is not significant, then you say, okay, we say Aham Tva, no worries, right? Your point I'm making is about the meaning. If you want to say it this way, that way, it's okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, actually, thank you for asking the question. I wanted to ask that question. Srivas Pandit Prabhu. We were discussing some time ago, isn't Hare Ram, like if we start from Hare Ram, it's a Gayatri mantra, so to make it eligible for common people to recite it, Mahaprabhu reversed it. Is that true?
Yes, so that's one of the explanations also, that it wasn't available for everyone to recite, and therefore Mahaprabhu switched it, and now everyone can recite the verse. So that's another one as well. But you bring up the point of Gayatri, and this is another good point to this same theme that we're talking about, which is Gayatri Mantra these days in India and amongst Hindus in general has become like this Mahamantra, where they're blaring it over the loudspeakers and everyone is chanting and yagyas, and you know, it's like kids are doing it in their fancy dress events. And it's not only lack of effectiveness, it's also very dangerous, right? It's the last thing you'd want your kids to do without proper, it's like that Indra Shatru Vivardhaswa thing. You don't know what effect can result. Gayatri is a Vedic mantra. It's found in the Rig Veda. It's a Vedic mantra, and therefore all these rules apply to the Gayatri mantra, right? So this is why we only receive Gayatri mantra after a certain point in our practice. Not because it is more effective than the Mahamantra, but because it requires more technological sophistication in order to deploy the mantra in the way that Mahamantra doesn't. And therefore, if one is not interested or feeling capable, or life circumstances are such that it's unlikely that one will be able to chant that mantra properly in the proper state of purity, etc., then there's no real need for Gayatri Diksha, right? It's only for specific applications. When we have technological applications, deity worship, the mantras and mudras we do is another spiritual technology, right? This is called tantra, and it's very, very powerful. So when you have a need to apply in that way, then okay, we need Gayatri mantra. But if we don't have a need for that, then Mahamantra is sufficient, right? Because the power of the Mahamantra envelops the power of the Gayatri Mantra. The Gayatri Mantra is one little circle inside the circle of the Mahamantra. So everything that is in the Gayatri Mantra is included in Krishna's holy names. It's just that it's technologically a little more focused and sophisticated, which means that it's useful for certain contexts and certain applications. And that's why we give it when devotees need to do particular services, like deity worship, for example. Otherwise, not necessary so much.
One point from this. So, regarding the Hare Krishna Mahamantra, which is, I think, Gauraprabhu and Srivastava Prabhu, it's basically, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't change anything.
the original mantra is starting with Hare Krishna. Lately, somebody just pointed out the Chaitanya Mahaprabhu changed the original. They changed the original to the old one, Hare Rama, and they complained that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu changed it. But if you see, that Lord Chaitanya didn't change anything. That was even Narayan Maharaj and many other has given their commentary on the actual Mahamantra, who changed it. Actually, Lord Chaitanya didn't touch it. It was the actual Hare Krishna, the actual one, which is found in the Vedas.
So that's the ultimate defense. He didn't change it at all. And the essential point is you've got Krishna's holy names, right? So niyamita smarane na kahala, that's the main point. You chant this part first or this part first. But we do as Mahaprabhu has taught us, Hare Krishna first. Okay. A lot of hands are there. Did you have a follow-up to this, or was it a separate question? Oh, okay. let's do a couple more people, and then just to make sure everyone gets an opportunity. In the far back there.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. So after hearing about the Vedic mantras, I have this question that, so if precession is so important, like in the time, place, circumstances, then aren't we discounting the spirit or the bhava with which we do the activity? In Vedic mantras, for example, in like Hare Krishna Mahamantra, it appears that time, place and circumstances don't have a role to play, but then the bhava or the spirit does. And in the Vedic mantras, is it vice versa?
Yes, exactly. In the Vedic mantras, the bhava is very little important. It's practically unimportant as to what mood or what reason you're doing it. I mean, think about Dvashta, right? His bhava was, let me kill Indra. And the result he got was completely opposite of that result. So this is the problem, actually, especially for Kali Yuga, is that the bhava, I mean, look at the Brajavasis when they're doing the Indra Yajna. That's a Vedic Yajna they're doing to satisfy Indra. Their bhava was to please Indra. They did not want to offend Indra. They were following what Krishna said because they wanted to follow Krishna, but it wasn't that they were doing it out of spite for Indra. And yet, as a result of his discontinuing that yajna, Indra got so upset, he nearly destroyed them. So this is the problem, is that with the Vedic mantras and their caretakers, which are the demigods, the devas, the bhava is minimally important in the Vedic chanting.
So that means Vedic mantras are more ritualistic than spiritualistic.
Definitely, and this is why they're called karmakanda, right? And this is precisely, and this brings us to a key point, right? This is precisely then why Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, he is not impressed by the Vedas, right? He says that the flowery language of the Vedas, the language is beautiful and it's powerful, but it's not going to help develop this spirit of detachment, of spiritual knowledge, that he is vyavasayatmika buddhi ekeha kur. It's not going to develop that, right? Because bahushaka hinantascha buddhayo vyavasayanam. Your intelligence becomes everywhere, right? The purity of your buddhi is not a consideration in the Vedic mantras. You can be a very materialistic, expert Vedic chanter, right? And that's perfectly fine. The Vedas will still be effective, even though your mind is completely polluted with material desires. No problem. Right? So when we hire Brahmins to do particular rituals, it's okay. As long as they know how to chant everything properly, doesn't matter who they are, they can do it. Right? But you're not going to get spiritual advancement as a result of that Kar Puja or whatever.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. So you very nicely mentioned that, you know, we can take the holy name of Krishna in any situation, any location, any, you know, situation of the body. But I think you also mentioned that, you know, it is very important to have the state of mind focused on the lotus feet of Krishna. So, because there is a subtle difference between, you know, situation of the body and state of the mind. So could you please elaborate a little bit on that so that, you know, we can remember nicely?
Yes, actually, when we move on in a few minutes, then there's going to be, we're going to talk a little bit about this difference, how the role of pronunciation in the chanting of the Mahamantra and other such Vaishnav Krishna Katha how that is different, and the role of intention and of the mind and one's bhava in that. So if we can hold on for just a minute.
Thank you.
Yes. So in the interest of time, we'll have another session for questions, but let's keep moving on here since we have to conclude this first session at 10:30. So hopefully you get a sense of the power of oral transmission, number one, of the glories of the Vedic tradition, why it's a tradition that we as Vaishnavas can be very proud of, and why we align ourselves with the Vedic culture. There's one little last point that I wanted to make in this regard, and that is the actual sacrificial arena. When the yajna is being performed and the Brahman is offering various things into the sacrifice, as a result of those offerings, he is affecting, he is maintaining the world, right? Affecting change in the world. He's paying his dues. By doing these Vedic yajnas, Krishna says, there develops a relationship of giving and taking between us and the devas and the demigods. Right? We give them, they give us sunlight and rain and all of that, and we give them payment for those goods through the Vedic sacrifice. Right? So, dehimam dadamite. I give you, you give me. Right? That's the relationship. It's an economy of exchange between us and the demigods. That happens through the medium of the yajna itself. And the yajna becomes a microcosm that affects the macrocosm, that changes something in the big picture. The little picture changes something in the big picture. Now, the analogy for this is just like when you want light and heat in your home, so you need, the power company provides the light and the water company and all of that provides water. You need to pay your bills as a result. So to pay your bills, in the old times at least, you would write a check, right? Now, someone can look at that and say, why will spilling a little bit of ink on a piece of paper and putting it in an envelope somehow keep your lights on? It's a pretty ridiculous proposition, right, to think that way. For someone who doesn't know the economy behind it, that putting some money into an envelope, putting a piece of paper saying, I promise to pay, and sending it, putting another little sticker on the corner, sticking it in a little box, and all of a sudden it'll be paid. It's a ridiculous proposition. But for someone who knows, they understand that by sacrificing that ink on that little sacrificial arena of your checkbook and putting it into the mail, you're going to keep your lights on. This is true of the Vedic sacrifice as well. By offering the grains into the little square of the fire, you're going to keep the sun and the moon shining and the rain falling. In our context, this is also true of deity worship and the various sorts of yajnas and so on we do for the deities, is that a skeptical person may say, well, how is this possible? Right? You're saying that there's going to be, parjanyadanna sambhava, right? That there's going to be a rain as a result of you banging the drum in this room? Mm-hmm. How is that possible, right? That's a ridiculous proposition. Or because you're doing nice puja, therefore the world is going to be peaceful and harmonious and Krishna is going to give a lot of rains. But it's the same idea, right? The microcosm affects the macrocosm. The little thing has the ability to change the big thing. When we do our mantras for the deities on the altar, not just we benefit, but the whole city, the whole town becomes auspicious as a result of that sacrifice. When we do Sankirtan Yajna, which is also a yajna, then everything becomes auspicious, right? It says that the Vedas say that, the Puranas say that when you chant, the devotees chant with their hands upraised in the air, then they push away all the bad influences of the different planets. So we don't have to do we don't have to do the Navagraha Puja and all of that, right? Because we're dancing in Kirtan and that's sufficient, right, for that. So again, microcosm, what happens in this little temple room affects what happens in the big, big universe at the same time, okay? So all of these principles, they come down straight from the Vedic times, And these Vedic mantras are the origin of the Sanskrit language that we want to talk about, okay? So That background I wanted to give you. Like I said, it's not specifically related to being able to learn the language, but I think it helps us appreciate some of the ancient origins and the glories of the tradition that we align ourselves with. When we say this is Vedic culture, then this is what we can be proud of, okay, when we speak of that. Now, let's now focus more then on the Sanskrit itself. Okay. Sanskrit is called Devavani, the language of the demigods, and it's we regard as the mother of all languages because it's an ancient language that is apaurusheya. It's not created by human beings, because the Vedas are apaurusheya, not created by human beings, and the Vedas are written in Sanskrit. Scholars today won't go that far, but they will. They agree that Sanskrit is the largest family of languages in the world is the Indo-European family of languages, okay? And the Indo-European family of languages includes Sanskrit and all the North Indian languages, so Hindi, Gujarati, Punjabi, Marathi, all of that. That's one branch, the current North Indian languages, but that family also includes most of the European languages, so Greek and Latin and all the languages that have descended from the Greek and Latin. So German and French and Spanish and Italian and Russian and Ukrainian.